This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we're talking with a law and politics expert about a new lawsuit that argues Wisconsin's legislative maps are unconstitutional and wants them redrawn. Now, though, it's Food Friday. Thanks for being with us. A bottle of wine can seem like a great gift. It's classy and thoughtful. But trying to pick one out of the store can be daunting. It feels like there's this endless variety of reds and whites from all over the world, and it can be hard to tell what the differences are and which ones anybody might like. The same is true for navigating an extensive wine list at a nice restaurant or an upscale bar, you know, or a not so upscale bar. It's just not easy to be an informed consumer on this front. Reed Joseph, though, is here to help. He's the beverage director at the Tasting Room of Monona and an expert on wine, beer, and spirits. Reed, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Most wine drinkers have like some basic sense of a category they like. That might be dry reds or semi-sweet whites, or maybe just like, I'll take a red or white. I mean, where do we start to try to separate the differences, even at the most basic level?
I think that with wine, a lot of people overcomplicate it because the wine industry can overcomplicate it. The easiest way I like to try to demystify wine for people is that at the end of the day, when you're looking at all the different names of wines, most of those are just the different grapes they're made out of. And that's a little, it's a very basic detail that I think a lot of people somehow missed when, you know, they started drinking wine. But like, if you go to the grocery store and you're in the apple section and you're like, I don't like Red Delicious, but I do like Honeycrisp, that's the same mindset with, you know, getting wine. Cabernet Sauvignon, that's just one of the grapes. Merlot, that's just one of the grapes. And figuring out what wine you like, the first part is, hey, I know I like this grape. I know I like the way it tastes. I'm going to keep enjoying the thing I like. Like, there's a zillion details below that, but that's kind of the foundation I like to start with.
I'm going to take your metaphor and torture it a little bit.
Excellent.
You gave us Honeycrisp and Red Delicious, but is liking white or reds similar to that? Is it similar to Granny Smith apples and Red Delicious? Like, how do you know if you like whites, are you going to like all whites?
Most wine is going to drop into either the black grape category or the white grape category. They make red wine out of black grapes. They make white wine out of white grapes. The color from red wine comes from sitting on the skins, though. So all grape juice is going to come out clear. With red wine, they take those black grapes, they let the wine sit on the skins. That develops the flavors in a different way. That being said, though, it's not like one is inherently better than the other. They just present differently. There's a saying I like to use at my bar, which is the only wrong way to drink is if somebody else tells you you have to drink. So if you're out there and you're like, hey, I like this wine with that food, and someone's like, that's not allowed, like, you can kindly tell that person to be quiet.
Excellent. I do love permission to tell someone to pipe down. Now is the time to join our conversation with Reed Joseph at 800-642-1234. On this Food Friday, we're talking about wine, and we want to know what questions you have. Do you find it hard to know what to order or what to buy at the store? Maybe you actually know a lot about wine and you have a really specific question that you want to try to stump Reed with. He's game. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Reed, some wines that are labeled as a single variety, like a Cabernet, they're actually partial blends and not purely the grape that they're labeled. So you just walked us through this kind of differentiation between the grapes, and now there are some of those additional layers. How does that work, and how can we tell what we're actually going to get?
The short version is it's really hard. In the United States, the laws about making wine are not as strict as they are in the European Union. So if you're buying a bottle and it says Cabernet Sauvignon, legally it has to be a minimum of 75% Cabernet Sauvignon. The rest can be any other grape they put in. Different, you know, wine regions are trying to lift that up a little bit, make it a little bit more stringent, but it makes being an informed consumer difficult. A great sign if you're trying to get high quality wine is you want to know where it came from. So if you pick up a bottle of wine and it says Red Wine California, that's any number of grapes from anywhere across, you know, a massive state like California. On the other hand, if you pick up a bottle of wine and on the back it says 20% Cab, 80% Merlot from Napa Valley, you know a lot more specifically about that. Deciphering wine labels is one of the most frustrating things, you know, even still for myself, and you can imagine more so for the average consumer. But if you get to the point where you can at least look at a bottle and say, okay, I at least know that's a place, like a one specific place, like that's a great start. A lot of bottles will also tell you exactly what's going on into it. And at the end of the day, there's nothing wrong with picking a bottle of wine and pulling your phone out and Googling it and saying, hey, if this little thing I found online says it's made of this. And, you know, that takes an extra minute in the aisle that I'm usually happy to spend.
Where do you recommend people start if they really just don't know?
The best way to start is to find a bar with a fun wine list and make friends with the bartender. Make yourself a regular at a bar with a fun wine list. And proper nerds will not shut up about the thing they're nerdy about. And so if you go to, I mean, like I can think of a couple of really fun wine bars around town or like bars with good bartender culture. Shameless plug for the tasting room, of course. But if you go to a bar with a fun wine list and you get to talking to the bartender and, you know, you try different things, that's a great way to have an actual person explain, hey, you should try this because I like it and this is why I like it, rather than what somebody on liquor.com wrote, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah. And I imagine while you're in the Madison area, there are bartenders like that and places like that all over the state of Wisconsin and certainly beyond that would be willing to listen when someone says, I actually don't know very much about this. Can you give me some advice? Fair to ask, or should we be afraid to be judged?
No, and this, I think that a great sign of a bad bartender is one that doesn't really want to engage with you and have a conversation. I think a bartender that doesn't want to demystify all of the things going on behind the bar, like, I don't know, that to me just reeks of insecurity. And so a good bartender is going to be like, yeah, absolutely, let me help you out with this, because it's fun. It's really enjoyable and fulfilling walking somebody through and showing them something new and watching them enjoy it and come back for more.
And what if I'm that's good advice for if I'm drinking a glass or want to try a couple when I'm out and about. But what if I'm walking into the wine aisle and I don't know where to start? Depending on where I'm shopping, there might not be somebody who is super informed who might be able to help me at the level that bartender might be able to.
My go-to for people is start with Italy and France. They're both ridiculously massive wine industries and it's really complicated, but there are some buzzwords in wine and some styles that have been very popular to the point where now the price becomes inflated because people think it's supposed to be popular. It's supposed to be expensive. On the other hand, there's small, tiny regions in places like, you know, Italy and France that make these wines that you can buy a bottle for $10 and it's going to outperform a $40 bottle of California Red. And I'm a lot happier if I buy a $10 bottle of wine and it doesn't turn out great. That hurts a lot less than if I buy a $40 or $50 bottle and it doesn't turn out great. So I generally say start, like, go to the France and Italy aisle and look at the incredible array of all of the things and don't be intimidated by how many things there are and just pick up a bottle in the $10 to $15 range. And if you like it, look at the label and say, I'm going to try that again next time.
Are there certain characteristics that are common in wines produced in those different countries? You know, you've tossed out, you know, France and Italy or even Spanish wines.
There are. And this is where you're going to get into. I'm going to try not to get too nerdy on this. You're going to get into the difference between the grapes that are used, the way the winemaker wants to make the wine, the traditional historical style of the wine from that region, and also the environment. There's this word in the wine world called terroir. And terroir is this very, very large word because it encompasses the climate, the geography, the precipitation, you know, the altitude, the kind of the soul of the region where the wine is made. And if you've had a French Pinot Noir versus a California Pinot Noir, you're going to get a very different flavor. And that's terroir. So, yeah, there's going to be some things you'll notice about maybe northern French wine or southern French wine, and some things you notice about southern Italian wine, and piecing apart how much of that is traditionally wine from that region is made this way and how much of it is the climate encourages it, that's a moving target.
If I'm not overly familiar, will I notice those nuances when I try the wines?
Probably not.
I think that makes it safer, though,
yeah,
for me, you know?
And this, you know, this goes back to... I think a lot of people in the wine industry try to make the wine industry complicated. And I don't know why that is. If I was being cynical, I would say it's because, you know, the wine industry sometimes struggles. And if you make your job feel important, then you might make yourself feel a little bit more secure. But your average person is not going to tell the difference between a expensive wine or a cheap wine. I would say, like, once you go above $6, $7, then the wine is probably going to be pretty decent, especially for imported European wines. One of my favorite studies, this was done a long time ago, but self-described sommeliers or wine experts were, you know, given a red wine to try and a white wine to try and asked to describe the tasting notes. And they described the red as being dark fruit and rich and the white as being light and crisp. And it turns out it was the same white wine, just one had food coloring. So you, people can be fooled. You have to drink a lot of wine and really get down into the weeds in it before you're debating about, you know, left bank versus right bank Bordeaux. I might have just angered a bunch of wine nerds by saying that, but if you're looking for a good bottle of wine for a Friday night, that's generally you shouldn't be worried about the details.
That's good to know. We've got Tasting Room of Monona Beverage Director Reed Joseph here for Food Friday. He's helping us with some tips for beginners to make wine more approachable, from the driest reds to the sweetest whites, everything in between. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How much do you know about the wine that you drink? How do you pick the bottle or the glass? Do you sometimes find wines hard to navigate? Or do you feel pretty confident and want to share some tips? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Still time for your call as we continue talking about wine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. It's Food Friday, and we're on a journey to better understand wine and make that extensive wine list at a bar or a restaurant more approachable. Reed Joseph is our guest. He's the beverage director at the Tasting Room of Monona. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. I want to welcome Bill in Burlington. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, I don't have anything contrary at all to what your guest has offered, but maybe some additional. One is to shop a your local liquor store that has a lot of wine bins, because typically there'll be an expert there, and you can talk about what you want to do with it, whether it's drinking standalone or you're going with a meal. And if you're introducing yourself to it, it's kind of nice to get together with some friends and maybe try some budget-wise, compare palettes, and find out where it's going from. The other dimension is I'm a hobbyist winemaker. I have about 160 vines, mostly Minnesota hybrids, and so there are wines being grown in Wisconsin and commercially sold that are great, that are worth trying. And if your wine bug goes deeper, you can often get kits to make wine to see if you like to do it, and it's another way to explore styles. At the home level.
Very interesting, Bill. Thank you so much for sharing. And a very fun thing that you do. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, he's absolutely right. And I'm going to give a shout out to two of my personal favorite liquor stores, Riley's Wines of the World on Gorham Street and then Star Liquor on Willie Street. You know, both of them have very fun, very interesting selections and, you know, staff who really like showing people what's going on. I also like to buy wine from Woodman's too because it's convenient. But if I'm hunting for something fun, I'm probably going to a place where I can have a conversation with somebody who is able to help me, again, further demystify it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, we do have this posted on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So those recommendations are out of the Madison area. But if you have a great place that you like to go, you're welcome to share that with us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can just leave a comment for us and we'll check it out. We have another caller. Scott from Green Bay wants to join us here. Hey, Scott.
Oh, hello. Yeah, I just want to say my wife and I really enjoyed sampling wines. And so we started with a wine club. But then we ended up creating a spreadsheet and tracking all of our wines on the spreadsheet and repeats and what we ate with it and such. But and any comment that we may have about the wine that we had. So I think our spreadsheet is well over 800 bottles long now. But one of the things we noticed is how we progressed from like a sweeter white wine up towards the drier reds, which is kind of our favorite now. So I was wondering if you had any comment about how people progress through wines, starting from where they start and where they end up.
Yeah, Scott, and I'm going to let Reed respond, but I want to let you know that he got quite a big smile. The corners of his eyes crinkled when you started to explain that you had a wine spreadsheet. So I want to make sure that you know that Reed appreciates your effort, Scott. Reed, what about this idea that we kind of sometimes get into sweeter wines and then develop and change our tastes over time?
First of all, I love spreadsheets, so thank you, Scott. You sound like a guy right after my own heart. I think that's not just true of wine. I think it's true of a lot of things. I think that a lot of people, like take coffee, for example. A lot of people, when they start drinking coffee, they start with lattes or mochas. And especially if they're drinking good coffee, eventually take out, you know, the added ingredients until they're sipping on straight black coffee or espresso. And with wine, I could say with cocktails or with any other, you know, thing you get into, getting into the approachable stuff is a great way to start. And then once you get used to that, you know, digging deeper and trying something outside your comfort zone. You know, I didn't think I liked red wine, you know, for years because I was just trying kind of the cheapest sweet red wines. And then I started trying wines that were maybe a little bit more developed, a little bit more character, and realized, oh, I actually really enjoy these. And then that rabbit hole just doesn't really stop. You wind up with 800 bottles in your spreadsheet.
Right. Well, I think Scott understands that very well. What about sparkling wines? We've talked about red wines and white wines. And sometimes I feel like sparkling wines have, you know, a bit of a reputation of their own.
Sparkling wines can be tricky because, you know, there's all these memes about the Champagne region of France. And a lot of people will then on the flip side, you know, kind of take a rhetorical hammer to American sparkling wines. And the thing with sparkling wine, I think that might make it a little bit less complicated is that every region is going to have kind of their own way of doing it. The French way where, you know, they take a little bit of the yeast and they bottle it and then they reseal it. And then the wine continues to ferment inside the bottle. And that's where a lot of the bubbles come from. Like that's a way of doing it. It's a very popular way of doing it. And if you pick up a bottle of sparkling wine and you see Method Traditionnel or Champagne Method, like that's going to give you a clue that, hey, this wine is made in the style of Champagne, even if it's not from the Champagne region. But then there's other wines like Cava from Spain, where they add the yeast to allow it to ferment, but then they put it in these large racks and, you know, let it, you know, rotate it in big batches. And so a cava and champagne use different grapes. But for a lot of people, a great way to start getting into sparkling wine is through cava, because you can find cava sometimes at a less intimidating price point than you can find champagne. The kind of, to me, at least the bottom rung is when you see things like force carbonated wines, where they basically take a very dry white wine and they add CO2 to it, like you would a soda. And that's, you know, that's the stuff that's $5 a bottle. And, you know, that's the stuff that is not, it's going to be there for your Instagram reel, not for you to sip on.
Different purposes for different beverages. That's good to know. Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's sparkling wine is, it's a really fun rabbit hole for me personally. It was kind of one of the first styles that my wine mentor really helped me get into. For anybody in the Madison area, the tasting room is doing a tasting on sparkling wine next Tuesday at 5 in the afternoon, which will be really fun for me because then I get to, you know, nerd out for like an hour and a half on sparkling wine. So like anytime I get to go further down the hole is fun for me. But as a rule of thumb, that word method traditionnel or champagne method is, you should see that as like a big signpost of, hey, try me, because even if I'm not from Champagne, I'm going to be made properly.
Great. Thanks for the tip. We're talking with Reed Joseph, who's walking us through the wine list, helping better equip us to find the bottle that's best for us. And we are taking calls. We've got Ruth Ann in Madison, who is ready to talk with us about wine. Hey, Ruth Ann.
Hi. I was wondering what, I like really dry red wines, and I'm wondering if there are any organic ones that you recommend. And I have a second question about sometimes a Cabernet, for example, or a Merlot, whatever, will sometimes leave a really awful taste in my mouth, and then other times it doesn't. And I'm wondering why that might be.
Thank you so much, Ruth Ann. We appreciate your call. What do you think, Reed?
As far as the awful taste in your mouth, my guess would be poorly developed tannins. And that's a lot of words that don't make sense to like a maybe he doesn't know, but like the thing about wine where it sits on your tongue, kind of like tea does, that's, you know, what they call tannins. It's one of the compounds that comes out of the skins when you're making red wine. And in the same way that, again, using coffee as an example, some dark French roast coffee is really bitter in a charcoal way, and some dark black coffee is very bitter in a pleasant way. Sometimes the wine, the red wine, especially when you give really heavy grapes like Cabernet Sauvignon, the way the tannins sit, it just lingers. It's like kind of like you took a bite of drywall. And, you know, sometimes when you have better developed tannins, that doesn't happen. One of the factors is age. As the wine ages in the bottle, it might, you know, it's going to develop a little bit more and those tannins will be softer. Maybe how the wine was stored, if it, you know, maybe got too hot or too cold, then some of the acidity might be coming out a little bit more. I guess I'm trying to think through, like, the last time I had a wine that I took a sip and I was just like, you know, had to wash my mouth out with soap afterwards. But as far as organic wines, there are a lot of great organic wineries, and they'll usually tell you on the bottle. The wine industry in general is moving more in the direction of organic, what they call biodynamic, you know, more sustainable farming and winemaking practices. And so when a wine is made organic, they'll let you know. We have a couple of organic wines on our list, but that's usually when somebody brings in the wine and it's organic, it's the first thing out of their mouth. And so, you know, pick up a couple of bottles, and if it's organic, it'll have a big sticker on the back letting you know.
Excellent. Probably worth a try if that's the kind of wine that you're looking for. Also, again, if you see an organic wine on a list that you could buy by the glass, try it out that way first.
Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite ways to find wine is, you know, I'll try a glass of it and then go and, you know, buy that bottle somewhere I think I can find it. Mm-hmm. The little bit of inside baseball on this is most restaurants price their wine where the price of the glass is what you pay for the bottle wholesale. And they do that so that if somebody buys one glass and then maybe they don't serve that wine for the next couple of days, they can pour the bottle of wine out and at least they recoup their cost. So if you're at a restaurant and you try your wine and it's $14 a glass and it's excellent, you can probably find that wine somewhere for $15-16 a bottle.
Excellent. These are perfect tips, Reed. I feel like I am more equipped to walk into the weekend now. I want to say thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Reed Joseph is the beverage director at the Tasting Room of Monona. He was with us on this Food Friday to teach us about wine, make us a little more informed consumers of our favorite reds and whites. And again, we've got this posted on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So if you'd like to contribute and continue the conversation, that's where you can go. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. We're about to talk about the latest on a new lawsuit challenging the way Wisconsin lawmakers have drawn voting maps. And we want to let you know about another legislative conversation on the Ideas Network. On Monday, the morning show is covering how Wisconsin lawmakers are considering ways to block the government from closing churches and other houses of worship during national emergencies. WPR State Capitol reporter joins the show to explain why Republican state leaders are considering a constitutional amendment. You can hear that on the morning show on Monday. It starts at 7 o'clock here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Now on Central Time, a new lawsuit filed Wednesday aims to redraw Wisconsin's Republican-favored legislative maps. The suit argues that Wisconsin's legislative maps are extremely partisan and that they violate the Wisconsin Constitution. We're talking to a political scientist about what the lawsuit argues and where the case could go from here. And we want to hear from you. The number to call is 800-642-1234. What do you wonder about the process of drawing voting districts or suing over those borders? Do you think Wisconsin's current voting maps are fair? Do you feel represented by our state legislature? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest to navigate this is Charlie Jacobs. He's a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. Charlie, it's good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you.
This new lawsuit claims Wisconsin's maps are unconstitutional. What's the argument?
Well, it's actually a rather broad argument. This is one of those throw a pan of spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks, because there are five different approaches that these litigants are taking in the case. One is just a basic argument, as you noted at the top, that these are extreme partisan gerrymands that are creating an unconstitutional advantage for the Republican Party and for Republican candidates. The second is that there's an equal protection clause, a state equal protection clause violation. That is, that the state is treating one group of people as superior and another as inferior. And that way you're have an imbalance in the power that each voter has. There's also a free speech issue that's being raised, a free association issue being raised, and just one regarding the issue of free and open government for people under the state constitution. So there's a lot there that the court will have to grapple with if they decide to take this case under their original jurisdiction. But I think that's strategic to try to see whether or not the court is amenable to any of the arguments that are being offered.
And when you're talking about original jurisdiction, you're talking about how the Supreme Court of the state can choose to take a case from the very beginning. It does not have to go through all of the lower courts to get to them.
That's exactly correct. So we're kind of, this is the game of Monopoly. You're skipping every space and going right to go and collecting your constitutional outcome that you want. That's the kind of approach that they're taking here. Now, it's not clear that the court will take this case under original jurisdiction. In their pleadings, they make a relatively strong argument for this, but there's this discretionary element to what the court gets to do. And because some of the facts in question have not yet been resolved, often courts will say, well, let's let a lower court resolve the issue of the factual record before we take it, because we're not really capable of doing that as the Supreme Court, that typically is only reviewing things on appeal.
What kind of facts can you point to that aren't yet resolved?
Well, I just think it's a question about the makeup of the districts, some of the questions about how they're organized and whether or not they would be considered contiguous. And that is whether or not we have a full block of geography that's being represented by one person instead of sort of the crazy quilt that we see a little bit around the state. So there are a number of issues regarding whether or not people have been harmed. These issues often have to get resolved before the court is going to jump into these kinds of issues.
Well, Republican lawmakers are criticizing the timing, too. Advocates filed it one day after the latest Supreme Court justice was sworn in. Wisconsin voters elected Janet Protasiewicz, which tips the balance of the court, that seventh person, to be more liberal. What do you think of that strategy?
Well, it's not unexpected. You run one of the most expensive campaigns for a state Supreme Court judge ever. And I think you can expect if you win that people are going to bring cases they think are going to be treated favorably by the new membership on the court. Certainly, conservatives and Republicans would do the same thing if the conditions were changed. So the timing is not unusual. I think that one of the things that we have to keep in mind that Justice Hagedorn, while certainly has been siding with those who are more liberal on the court, has a history of being somewhat more conservative and Republican. And so it's not as though the 4-3 majority is going to be solid and continuous during the term of this particular court. But it is advantageous for these plaintiffs to bring this case at this time. And they want to do it now because with the impending 2024 elections, if they are successful, they may force the redrawing of these districts. And they're making an argument that some of the senators are going to have to run again, even though their term isn't up, because they're currently occupying districts that are unconstitutional. So they're really trying to shake up the electoral map for the next election. That is a tight time frame to try to get this all done in, especially if it has to go to the lower courts. So the timing had to be quick if they wanted to get this done by the 2024 election in November.
Hmm. Charlie Jacobs is a professor at St. Norbert College, and we're talking about a new lawsuit that challenges Wisconsin's voting maps. You can ask your questions, give us a call, help us understand how you feel about this at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. And we've got Andy in Appleton, who is ready to have a conversation with us. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I've been pretty excited about fair voting maps. I know the Wisconsin Coalition on Fair Maps proposed to Green Bay some different maps, and they took about 2 minutes to totally reject it. It wasn't appreciated, the effort at all. And I know Iowa has got fair voting maps, but they still vote overwhelmingly one way. And I've seen that in Wisconsin, too, so that even if we've fixed the voting districts and have fair maps, you still have this big trend going on in Wisconsin, which is rural Wisconsin still is overwhelmingly red. And still flies the Let's Go Brandon flags, and the cities urban areas are overwhelmingly blue. So that, even with fair voting districts, that trend is still going to exist in Wisconsin. And the last thing I was hoping to have someone address for me is, how come Wisconsin's got 4.5 million eligible voters, but only 3.5 million registered voters? That's a pretty big gap.
All right, Andy, thanks so much. I'm not sure, Charlie, I don't know if that last question is really within the scope of what we're talking about here. Do you know?
I mean, the short answer really is no one is compelled to register to vote or to vote, unlike, say, the nation of Australia, where you are required to show up and vote by law. It's a misdemeanor if you don't. People can choose to register or not. We don't have automatic registration. Certainly that could be effective if we automatically registered everybody who was qualified to vote. But that's not something that the public has, and politicians, quite honestly, have embraced, because it makes outcomes a little bit more ambiguous. When you know who the registered voters are, you have a tendency to know how they're likely to vote, and you can plan accordingly in your campaigns. It's a wild card when you have a bunch of new voters enter the fray, and that makes especially incumbent politicians very nervous. His first point.
Exactly.
I'm sorry,
that's what I was going to ask about, to Andy's first point, just about the nuance that even if we have what he would consider fair maps, he sees the communities that are urban versus rural going in different political directions.
And that's true. And certainly, I think even a better example might be something like the state of Kansas or the state of Missouri, where you really do have two centers of Democratic strength, which are in the more urban areas. And you can try all sorts of gymnastics to draw maps that are quote unquote fair, but you're still going to have a block of red in the middle of these states where there isn't a larger urban population that tends to vote more democratically. And so that would be a problem here in Wisconsin too. But the difficulty is that we'll take the 2018 elections in the state, where 53% of the legislative vote was in the direction of Democrats, and Democrats only won 36 of 99 assembly seats. There are a lot of Democrats, and yes, they are splayed across the state, but when you purposefully draw districts in a way which does one of two things, cracking or packing. And so cracking means we take a locus of Democrats or Republicans or any group, and you crack them and put them in various districts, diminishing their power to effectively compete for a seat. Packing is, well, you grab a whole bunch of like-minded individuals, put them into one district, often very oddly shaped. And while they win one seat, they empower the other districts around them to win in the alternative political direction. And so those two effects can be really problematic. And so when we talk about fair maps, we're just talking about drawing districts where you are creating more competition. It's not that Democrats or Republicans will win, it just creates more competition. That may have the effect of diminishing polarization in the United States, because you have to actually start to think about bargaining and compromise and being a little bit more centric in order to win your race, rather than just rolling to election day because all of your voters are either Democratic or Republican.
Your cracking and packing explanation might apply right now. We've got Agnes in La Crosse who has a question for us. Hi, Agnes.
Hey, here's my question. I'm in La Crosse, which is always Democratic, and we're packed in here pretty good. I'm curious if in the last election for the Assembly and for the Senate, were there more Republican votes cast in total or Democratic votes? Because, I mean, there were more Democratic votes cast for Protasiewicz. There were more Democratic votes cast for Evers twice. I'm curious, if you just look at the votes cast, did more Democrats vote? It's just that they were cracked.
Agnes, thank you so much for that question. What do you know about this, Charlie?
So I don't have off the top of my head that breakdown. So and the best way to look at it is, again, when we're talking about assembly seats and Senate seats, about the votes cast in the legislative elections. I don't have that off the top of my head. And,
sure.
And of course, one of the difficulties in this state is because you don't have to register as a Republican or a Democrat, and we have open primaries, it's often really hard to determine what percentage of the public considers themselves has a political identification as either a Democrat or a Republican. So that's a little bit hard to divine. And of course, since we don't join political parties like we would, say, the Elks Club, you know, you can change your mind anytime you want to. You can bounce from one party to the other. So it's this moving target. But 3 of 5 statewide races went to the Democrat. So it seems like there was a preference in the Democratic direction. Again, the last Supreme Court decision or race went to someone who was considered more liberal and a Democratic candidate, even though it's nominally nonpartisan. But this state does have and exhibits packing and cracking. That is, we are trying to, whoever is drawing the maps, is trying to create opportunities for the Republicans to win. And so they are trying to find pockets of Republicans and Democrats to put together or break apart in a way that creates this disadvantage. So right now, the Senate has a veto-proof majority and only 2 votes away in the Assembly for that. And so when you look at a state where, as you note, Agnes, you know, Evers has won twice and we've had some landslides for Democratic or liberal candidates, it seems odd that the state legislature is so overwhelmingly one party. And so that's the difficult issue here. And this is the issues that's being raised in this particular lawsuit.
We're talking with law and politics expert Charlie Jacobs about a new lawsuit challenging Wisconsin's Republican-favored legislative maps. Taking your calls along the way at 800-642-1234. This conversation continues next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, talking with Charlie Jacobs, professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. We're going over a new lawsuit that seeks to redraw Wisconsin's current voting maps, arguing that our current maps are unconstitutional. And Charlie, we've seen lawsuits over these same maps before. What is different about what we've seen this week?
So in my mind, what's different about this particular lawsuit is the strategy that the plaintiffs are taking. When you read this, although there are some mentions of federal case law and the United States Supreme Court, the focus of this case is almost exclusively on provisions within the state constitution and state law and state practice. And that matters because over the last several decades, the United States Supreme Court has been reluctant to the point of ignoring all pleas to end gerrymandering. And it's on a principle related to whether or not there's an actual case or controversy. And there is a doctrine at the United States Supreme Court level that says, if we deem this to be a political question, that is something to be resolved by the political branches and not through legal means, we're not going to decide the case. And so that's why in the past, even cases from Wisconsin have been dismissed in one form or another because they won't tackle the issue. And this is important because what the court is saying is, how are we supposed to determine what percentage of Republicans or Democrats are supposed to be in a district? It's beyond our capacity. So I think what the plaintiffs figured in this case was, it's kind of a loser of a case if we take it to the federal court. So what we're going to do is focus exclusively on state issues. That way the federal courts won't or can't get involved because it's exclusive to the sovereignty of Wisconsin and not to any issues of federal law or the federal constitution. So this is going to be a really interesting case because there's sort of very little wiggle room to appeal this to what many consider a very conservative Republican United States Supreme Court, and now with a more liberal-leaning state court, there might be some room for them to actually dismantle what they perceive to be unconstitutional gerrymanders at the state level.
What arguments can Republicans make to defend these maps that work in their favor?
Well, I think one of the ones that they're going to make is that in the Johnson series of cases that happened right after this post-2020 census was that the previous court made arguments about the simplest way to resolve the dispute between the governor and the legislature when Tony Evers rejected and vetoed the map created by the Republicans. They went to the state Supreme Court, which resolved the issue. And so I think what they're going to argue is we've resolved this issue before. The court offered an alternative, which was this approach to create sort of the least change possible from the 2011-2012 maps. And so I think what they're going to say is precedent should lead us to retaining these maps until the next census in 2030. And of course, the argument against that will be you're just entrenching your power. And since you'll be in power because of these unfair maps in 2030, that will just perpetuate into the future. And we will never have maps that, as Andy characterized, as fairer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for taking us through some of the background and kind of the process judicially that we have gone through to actually wind up with these maps in the first place, because that was also debated back and forth. We are talking with Charlie Jacobs about a new lawsuit filed to redraw Wisconsin's voting maps, and we're taking your calls. We've got Bruce in Cumberland on the line. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had caught a statistic on NPR a while ago about marijuana legalization, and over 60% of Republican voters want that legalization. And when it came around to a vote, the Republican-held legislature disenfranchised their constituents in that decision. We're also Wisconsinites first. They just tried to do it with education funding. So they hold their own people hostage. That would be clear to me that they would hold the blue side hostage. I think that makes it very difficult for me to be a Republican in this state.
Bruce, thank you for sharing that. I want Charlie to be able to weigh in on this idea that gerrymandering overly partisanly is leading to disenfranchisement, not just for the other party, but also for your same constituents.
Well, and it goes to a deeper Democratic debate about, you know, small d Democratic debate about what representatives are supposed to do. Are they supposed to sort of serve a delegate function where they're reflexively meeting the demands and needs of constituents? Or are they supposed to take an approach where they instead are trying to use their own best judgment to the benefit of the public, whether or not the public likes it or not? It's kind of like, you know, forcing a kid to take castor oil when they don't want to. And the argument would be from the state legislature, well, we've seen the data, we understand the dynamics of legalizing marijuana, so even though you may want it, it's not a prudent approach to take. And so it depends on your approach. Do you want them to have this sort of delegate function, or do you want them to be in some ways supervisory over our own wants and needs to make sure that the right choice, in air quotes, is being made? And so, you know, that's often a personal decision by a legislator, and we have to rely on the public to make the choice about whether or not they're sufficiently meeting the needs of the public. And, you know, Bruce is right. This is a conundrum of any Democratic polity. We have to wonder about how we're being represented.
Mm-hmm. Charlie, this is a brand new lawsuit, but you mentioned that there is a really specific window of time if this might apply in 2024. What is the timeline for something like this moving through the judicial system?
Well, we're going to have to wait first and foremost to see whether or not the court is going to take this under its original jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And if it does, but there are facts that need to be resolved, there are methods by which they can engage actors to help create the factual record. So that will take some time. And then, of course, there will be hearings before the court. Now, if they reject original jurisdiction, well, it's going to have to be refiled, and we're going to have to go through the process fact-finding and appeals. And so it's unlikely that you're going to see that before the 2024 election to give the legislature or the courts time to draft new maps. So this may extend into midterm elections in 2026 and beyond. So this could drag out a while. There's no guarantee that there's going to be an immediate resolution of this issue.
Does the Wisconsin Supreme Court have any sort of deadline?
Not really.
Right.
You know, but I think the liberals on the court are very likely energized with their new majority, and they may be very willing to take some of these cases that have been percolating but have not arrived on their doorstep because of the hesitance to bring it to a conservative court. So for all we know, they're going to stomp on the gas pedal and go. But that also might create some legitimacy issues with the court, that they look far too partisan. So they may take at least some time to determine how they're going to act on this matter.
Got it. Charlie, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Charlie Jacobs, professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. We talked with him about a new lawsuit challenging Wisconsin's voting maps and how it could affect future elections. And now we'll have to wait and see. This is Central Time.